This is Audible.
As Sir Arthur C. Clarke himself was known to say, "Greetings, carbon-based bipeds. I'm Hugo and Nebula Award-winning science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer. The novel you're about to hear is Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke. I think Clarke was the greatest science fiction writer of the 20th century, and this novel is widely regarded as his masterpiece. And more than half a century after it was first published, it's still relevant and timely, for it details, in part, a world on the verge of nuclear disaster, something that, sadly, once again seems plausible. In fact, it's fascinating to compare this early work by Clarke with his final one, The Last Theorem, his collaboration with Fred Pohl, published shortly after Sir Arthur's death in 2008. In both Childhood's End and The Last Theorem, a solution is found to the problem of some portion of humanity wanting to blow the rest of us up. But in Childhood's End, that solution comes from aliens, whereas in The Last Theorem, it's we humans that devise our own answer. And maybe that's the real end of childhood for science fiction. Moving beyond the fervent hope that beings from the stars will uplift us from our current state to realizing that we ourselves will have to solve our own problems. Still, as I said, this is probably Clarke's best novel, but when he passed away, all the obituaries mentioned 2001: A Space Odyssey instead. Now, most accounts say that the screenplay of 2001 was inspired by Clarke's short story The Sentinel, and that's true as far as it goes. Just as in the opening of 2001, human astronauts find an artifact on the moon in The Sentinel, and the artifact signals its builders that humanity has now left Earth. But 2001 is really a story of transcendence, of rebirth, of the next stage in human evolution, and of encounters with almost godlike aliens. And the seeds for all of that are not in The Sentinel, but rather here, in Arthur C. Clarke's masterwork, the brilliant and heartbreaking Childhood's End.
Audible Frontiers presents Childhood's End, written by Arthur C. Clarke and read by Eric Michael Summerer.
Prologue. Chapter 1. The volcano that had reared Tarawa up from the Pacific depths had been sleeping now for 500,000 years. Yet, in a little while, thought Reinhold, the island would be bathed with fires fiercer than any that had attended its birth. He glanced towards the launching site, and his gaze climbed the pyramid of scaffolding that still surrounded the Columbus. 200 feet above the ground, the ship's prow was catching the last rays of the descending sun. This was one of the last nights it would ever know. Soon it would be floating in the eternal sunshine of space. It was quiet here beneath the palms, high up on the rocky spine of the island. The only sound from the project was the occasional yammering of an air compressor or the faint shout of a workman. Reinhold had grown fond of these clustered palms. Almost every evening he had come here to survey his little empire. It saddened him to think that they would be blasted to atoms when the Columbus rose in flame and fury to the stars. A mile beyond the reef, the James Forrestal had switched on her searchlights and was sweeping the dark waters. The sun had now vanished completely, and the swift tropical night was racing in from the east. Reinhold wondered, a little sardonically, if the carrier expected to find Russian submarines so close to shore. The thought of Russia turned his mind, as it always did, to Conrad and that morning in the cataclysmic spring of 1945. More than 30 years had passed, but the memory of those last days when the Reich was crumbling beneath the waves from the east and from the west had never faded. He could still see Conrad's tired blue eyes and the golden stubble on his chin as they shook hands and parted in that ruined Prussian village while the refugees streamed endlessly past. It was a parting that symbolized everything that had since happened to the world, the cleavage between East and West. For Conrad chose the road to Moscow. Reinhold had thought him a fool, but now he was not so sure. For 30 years, he had assumed that Conrad was dead. It was only a week ago that Colonel Sandmeier, of Technical Intelligence, had given him the news. He didn't like Sandmeier, and he was sure the feeling was mutual. But neither let that interfere with business.
"Mr. Hoffman," the colonel had begun, in his best official manner, "I've just had some alarming information from Washington. It's top secret, of course, but we've decided to break it to the engineering staff so that they'll realize the necessity for speed."
He paused for effect, but the gesture was wasted on Reinhold. Somehow he already knew what was coming.
"The Russians are nearly level with us. They've got some kind of atomic drive. It may even be more efficient than ours, and they're building a ship on the shores of Lake Baikal. We don't know how far they've got, but intelligence believes it may be launched this year. You know what that means."
"Yes," thought Reinhold, "I know. The race is on, and we may not win it."
"Do you know who's running their team?"
he had asked, not really expecting an answer. To his surprise, Colonel Sandmeier had pushed across a typewritten sheet, and there at its head was the name, Conrad Schneider.
"You knew a lot of these men at Peenemünde, didn't you?" said the colonel. "That may give us some insight into their methods. I'd like you to let me have notes on as many of them as you can, their specialties, the bright ideas they had, and so on. I know it's asking a lot after all this time, but see what you can do."
"Conrad Schneider is the only one who matters," Reinhold had answered. "He was brilliant. The others are just competent engineers. Heaven only knows what he's done in 30 years. Remember, he's probably seen all our results, and we haven't seen any of his. That gives him a decided advantage."
He hadn't meant this as a criticism of intelligence, but for a moment it seemed as if Sandmeier was going to be offended. Then the colonel shrugged his shoulders.
"It works both ways. You've told me that yourself. Our free exchange of information means swifter progress, even if we do give away a few secrets. The Russian research departments probably don't know what their own people are doing half the time. We'll show them that democracy can get to the moon first."
Democracy. Nuts, thought Reinhold, but knew better than to say it. One Conrad Schneider was worth a million names on an electoral roll. And what had Conrad done by this time, with all the resources of the USSR behind him? Perhaps, even now, his ship was already outward bound from Earth. The sun, which had deserted Tarutowa, was still high above Lake Baikal when Conrad Schneider and the assistant commissar for nuclear science walked slowly back from the motor test rig. Their ears were still throbbing painfully, though the last thunderous echoes had died out across the lake 10 minutes before.
"Why the long face?" asked Grigorovich suddenly. "You should be happy now. In another month, we'll be on our way, and the Yankees will be choking themselves with rage."
"You're an optimist, as usual," said Schneider.
"Even though the motor works, it's not as easy as that. True, I can't see any serious obstacles now, but I'm worried about the reports from Tarutowa. I've told you how good Hoffman is, and he's got billions of dollars behind him. These photographs of his ship aren't very clear, but it looks as if he's not far from completion. And we know he tested his motor 5 weeks ago."
"Don't worry," laughed Grigorovich. "They're the ones who are going to have the big surprise. Remember, they don't know a thing about us."
Schneider wondered if that was true, but decided it was much safer to express no doubts. That might start Grigorovich's mind exploring far too many torturous channels, and if there had been a leak, he would find it hard enough to clear himself. The guard saluted as he re-entered the administration building. There were nearly as many soldiers here, he thought grimly, as technicians. But that was how the Russians did things, and as long as they kept out of his way, he had no complaints. On the whole, with exasperating exceptions, events had turned out very much as he had hoped. Only the future could tell if he or Reinhold had made the better choice. He was already at work on his final report when the sound of shouting voices disturbed him. For a moment, he sat motionless at his desk, wondering what conceivable event could have disturbed the rigid discipline of the camp. Then he walked to the window, and for the first time in his life, he knew despair. The stars were all around him as Reinhold descended the little hill. Out at sea, the Forestall was still sweeping the water with her fingers of light, while further along the beach, the scaffolding round the Columbus had transformed itself into an illuminated Christmas tree. Only the projecting prow of the ship lay like a dark shadow across the stars. A radio was blaring dance music from the living quarters, and unconsciously Reinhold's feet accelerated to the rhythm. He had almost reached the narrow road along the edge of the sands when some premonition, some half-glimpsed movement, made him stop. Puzzled, he glanced from land to sea and back again. It was some little time before he thought of looking at the sky. Then Reinhold Hoffman knew, as did Conrad Schneider at this same moment, that he had lost his race. And he knew that he had lost it not by the few weeks or months that he had feared, but by millennia. The huge and silent shadows driving across the stars, more miles above his head than he dared to guess, were as far beyond his little Columbus as it surpassed the log canoes of Paleolithic man. For a moment that seemed to last forever, Reinhold watched, as all the world was watching, while the great ships descended in their overwhelming majesty, until at last he could hear the faint scream of their passage through the thin air of the stratosphere. He felt no regrets as the work of a lifetime was swept away. He had labored to take man to the stars, and in the moment of success, the stars, the aloof, indifferent stars, had come to him. This was the moment when history held its breath, and the present sheared asunder from the past as an iceberg splits from its frozen, parent cliffs, and goes sailing out to sea in lonely pride. All that the past ages had achieved was as nothing now. Only one thought echoed and re-echoed through Reinhold's brain. The human race was no longer alone. Part 1. Earth and the Overlords. Chapter 2. The Secretary General of the United Nations stood motionless by the great window, staring down at the crawling traffic on 43rd Street. He sometimes wondered if it was a good thing for any man to work at such an altitude above his fellow humans. Detachment was all very well, but it could change so easily to indifference. Or was he merely trying to rationalize his dislike of skyscrapers, still unabated after 20 years in New York? He heard the door open behind him, but did not turn his head as Peter Van Ryberg came into the room. There was the inevitable pause as Peter looked disapprovingly at the thermostat, for it was a standing joke that the Secretary General liked living in an icebox. Stormgren waited until his assistant joined him at the window, then tore his gaze away from the familiar yet always fascinating panorama below. "They're late," he said. "Wainwright should have been here 5 minutes ago." "I've just heard from the police. He's got quite a procession with him, and it snarled up the traffic. He should be here any moment now." Van Ryberg paused, then added abruptly, "Are you still sure it's a good idea to see him?" "I'm afraid it's a little late to back out of it now. After all, I've agreed. Though, as you know, it was never my idea in the first place." Stormgren had walked to his desk and was fidgeting with his famous uranium paperweight. He was not nervous, merely undecided. He was also glad that Wainwright was late, for that would give him a slight moral advantage when the interview opened. Such trivialities played a greater part in human affairs than anyone who set much store on logic and reason might wish. "Here they are," said Van Ryberg suddenly, pressing his face against the window. "They're coming along the avenue, a good 3,000, I'd say." Stormgren picked up his notebook and rejoined his assistant. Half a mile away, a small but determined crowd was moving slowly toward the Secretariat building. It carried banners that were indecipherable at this distance, but Stormgren knew their message well enough. Presently, he could hear, rising above the sound of the traffic, the ominous rhythm of chanting voices. He felt a sudden wave of disgust sweep over him. Surely the world had had enough of marching mobs and angry slogans. The crowd had now come abreast of the building. It must know that he was watching, for here and there fists were being shaken, rather self-consciously, in the air. They were not defying him, though the gesture was doubtless meant for Stormgren to see. As pygmies may threaten a giant, so those angry fists were directed against the sky 50 kilometers above his head, against the gleaming silver cloud that was the flagship of the Overlord fleet. And very probably, thought Stormgren, Karelin was watching the whole thing and enjoying himself hugely, for this meeting would never have taken place except at the supervisor's instigation. This was the first time that Stormgren had ever met the head of the Freedom League. He had ceased to wonder if the action was wise, for Karelin's plans were often too subtle for merely human understanding. At the worst, Stormgren did not see that any positive harm could be done. If he had refused to see Wainwright, the League would have used the fact as ammunition against him. Alexander Wainwright was a tall, handsome man in his late 40s. He was, Stormgren knew, completely honest, and therefore doubly dangerous. Yet his obvious sincerity made it hard to dislike him, whatever views one might have about the cause for which he stood, and about some of the followers he had attracted. Stormgren wasted no time after Van Ryberg's brief and somewhat strained introductions.
"I suppose," he began, "the chief object of your visit is to register a formal protest against the Federation scheme. Am I correct?"
Wainwright nodded gravely.
"That is my main purpose, Mr. Secretary. As you know, for the last 5 years we have tried to awaken the human race to the danger that confronts it. The task has been a difficult one, for the majority of people seem content to let the overlords run the world as they please. Nevertheless, more than 5 million patriots in every country have signed our petition."
"That is not a very impressive figure out of 2.5 billion.
"It is a figure that cannot be ignored, and for every person who has signed, there are many who feel grave doubts about the wisdom, not to mention the rightness, of this Federation plan. Even Supervisor Karelin, for all his powers, cannot wipe out 1,000 years of history at the stroke of a pen."
"What does anyone know of Karelin's powers?" retorted Stormgren. "When I was a boy, the Federation of Europe was a dream, but when I grew to manhood, it had become reality. And that was before the arrival of the overlords. Karelin is merely finishing the work we had begun.